In hushed police stations and grieving households across the globe, a single question whispers through the years. What truly happened here? From the eerie disappearance of a flight's hijacker to the brutal slaying of an Australian taxi driver, these are cases steeped in mystery and left unresolved. Imagine a ransom parachuted into the night sky, and a man vanishing into thin air. Picture a woman stabbed in a taxi and dumped in the bush, her killer still free decades later. Consider the chilling discovery of occult symbols around a teenager's corpse in New Jersey. These are not just headlines. They are razor-edge moments frozen in time, echoing in empty courtrooms and empty graves. Each case brings a shattered family, unrelenting investigators, new forensic breakthroughs, and relentless public intrigue. They challenge our trust in justice and push us to ask, could someone, somewhere, hold the final clue? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. November 24th, 1971, the night before Thanksgiving. A man walks into Portland International Airport wearing a black suit, a white shirt, a narrow black tie, and dark sunglasses. He carries only a briefcase. He identifies himself as Dan Cooper, and pays cash for a one-way ticket to Seattle on Northwest Orient Flight 305. What happens next will become one of the greatest unsolved crimes in American history. As the Boeing 727 takes off with 36 passengers and 6 crew members, nothing seems out of the ordinary. But shortly after the flight is airborne, Cooper hands a note to flight attendant Florence Schaffner. Thinking it's just another phone number from a pushy businessman, she tucks it away without reading it. Cooper leans closer and whispers, "Miss, you'd better look at that note. I have a bomb." The note reads, "I have a bomb in my briefcase. I want you to sit beside me." She does. Cooper opens the briefcase briefly to reveal wires and red cylinders. Then he calmly lays out his demands. $200,000 in cash, 4 parachutes, and a fuel truck standing by in Seattle for a refuel. If the demands are not met, he will blow up the plane. He speaks with boarding a ferry with a man days after the murder. But the CCTV tape from the ferry line was already erased. In 2020, after over a decade of dead ends, the South Australian government announced a $1 million reward for information leading to the conviction of Rachel's killer or the recovery of Mary. Dozens of tips came in. None credible. The case was reclassified as a homicide abduction. Public speculation exploded. Was Mary kidnapped by a stranger? Did someone known to Rachel take revenge? Was there a third party watching them in the mangroves? Theories ranged from family secrets to child trafficking rings, but nothing ever stuck. The one-blow theory. Rachel's cause of death, blunt force to the back of the head, suggests surprise. Perhaps someone struck her while she was distracted with Mary. The killer didn't harm Mary, but abducted her instead. The silent witness theory. Some believe Mary saw her mother's murder and fled, only to be found later by someone with dark intentions. The familiar face theory. The lack of struggle, the clean backpack, the strategic dump site, all suggest the killer may have been someone known to Rachel or Mary. Someone they didn't fear. Rachel's sister, Monique, has become the face of the campaign to find Mary. Every year on October 31st, she holds a vigil in the mangroves. She reads Mary's favorite book aloud, Where the Wild Things Are. In interviews, she often says, "Somewhere out there is a woman, maybe 20 now. Maybe she doesn't even know who she is, but she's my niece, and I won't stop until I know what happened to her." The Port Adelaide mangroves hold their secrets well. Rachel Vaughan's body washed up quietly, but her daughter never came home. No killer was caught, no grave was filled, just a backpack in a bin, a family in mourning, and a $1 million reward that no one has claimed. If Mary is still alive, her name has likely changed, her memories may be blurred or blocked, but somewhere deep inside, the truth is there, waiting to surface, like a body in the tide. Springfield, New Jersey, September 19th, 1972. A dog runs into a police station carrying a human forearm in its mouth. What follows is one of the most chilling and controversial cases in New Jersey history. The body belongs to Jeanette DePalma, a 16-year-old girl who had been missing for 6 weeks. Her remains are found on a wooded bluff known locally as the Devil's Teeth. Around her, a half circle of branches, strange stone arrangements, and what appeared to be a makeshift altar. To the police, it was a suspicious death. To the town, it was witchcraft. What happened to Jeanette DePalma still isn't clear, but one thing is certain. Whatever killed her didn't just take her life. It ignited a decades-long hysteria that still haunts Springfield today. Jeanette was last seen on August 7, 1972, leaving her home to visit a friend across town. She never arrived. For weeks, police believed she was a runaway. Her parents insisted she wasn't. She was deeply religious. She didn't do drugs. She had just started attending Bible study at a local church. But as the days passed, the case went cold. Until that dog showed up, with part of her remains. That moment changed everything. Jeanette's body was discovered on an abandoned quarry bluff known for local ghost stories. It was a place teens dared each other to visit, filled with graffiti, broken glass, and strange stories of rituals. Her remains were skeletal. Her clothes were torn and decomposed. No cause of death could be determined, but surrounding her were items that sparked panic. Twigs arranged in crosses, stones in geometric patterns, logs placed in a circle, and bones from small animals nearby. Locals whispered of satanic rituals. The papers ran with headlines like, "Witchcraft Murder? Occult Ritual in Springfield." Police neither confirmed nor denied, and the truth got buried, just like Jeanette. From the start, the investigation struggled. The body had decomposed too far for a definitive autopsy. Toxicology was impossible. The coroner listed the cause of death as undetermined. There were no signs of blunt force trauma, stabbing, or gunshots. But there were no defensive wounds either. No fingerprints, no blood trail, no suspects, only fear. And fear speaks loudest when facts are missing. In the months that followed, the town turned on itself. Local teens were interrogated. A group of hippies who camped near the woods were questioned. Members of fringe churches were labeled as suspects. Some pointed fingers at the local church Jeanette had joined, claiming they were a cult. Others blamed the police for ignoring earlier missing persons reports in the area. And through it all, an invisible suspect emerged, the occult. The press fueled the hysteria. Reporters dug into unrelated stories of grave robbing, animal sacrifices, and missing pets, connecting dots that may never have been there. The Springfield police tried to calm the public, but in 1973, they quietly closed the case. Decades later, when investigators and journalists tried to reopen it, they were stunned to learn. Most of the original police files were missing. Gone. No photos, no autopsy, no scene documentation, only hearsay and rumors. It was as if the case had been erased. In 2002, the case gained new attention when a local magazine, Weird NJ, ran a retrospective on Jeanette's story. Suddenly, letters poured in. One anonymous letter claimed, "I know who killed Jeanette. It was a group. They do things in the woods. They killed animals too. She saw something she shouldn't have." Another said, "The police knew but didn't want to go after them. Too many connections. She was left as a warning." No names, no proof, just fragments of terror. But many believe these letters were the first real clues in decades. One name eventually surfaced, Reverend Arthur Red W., a self-proclaimed spiritual healer with a history of mental illness. He had lived near the bluff and had reportedly led prayer circles in the woods. But no direct evidence tied him to Jeanette, and he died in 1999. Another man, Eugene C., was mentioned in several anonymous tips. He had a violent past, and some said he knew the bluff too well. But again, no proof. Every trail faded into silence. Modern technology has tried to revive the case. In 2020, a request was made to exhume Jeanette's body for forensic reevaluation. But without original police authorization and with much of the family relocated, legal complications stalled it. A request for DNA testing of clothing fibers was denied due to lack of chain of custody documentation, so the case remains stuck on the edge of science and myth. Criminal profilers have weighed in. Some believe Jeanette was likely killed by someone she knew, someone who lured her to the bluff and left her exposed, the symbolic arrangement of twigs and stones. Likely staged, either to mislead or after the fact. Others disagree. They believe the ritualistic clues were real, and that Jeanette may have stumbled upon something she was never meant to see. A third theory suggests mental illness or a jealous rival may have played a role. But without a body, a confession, or a witness, it's all speculation. Jeanette's surviving sister, Cindy, has been the lone torchbearer for decades. She still lives in New Jersey and gives occasional interviews. I don't believe she was killed by a devil worshiper. I believe she was killed by someone hiding behind the myth of devil worship. Cindy believes Jeanette was silenced, and the town used fear to forget her. 50 years later, Jeanette De Palma's death is a symbol of more than tragedy. It's a reminder of what happens when fear eclipses fact, when hysteria drowns out justice. Her bones were found on a bluff. But the real story lies in a community too frightened to look beyond the shadows. The devil may not have killed Jeanette, but someone did, and they're still out there. Washington, D.C., 1971. The city is caught between change and chaos. Civil rights protests, rising crime, and a community struggling to be heard. In the southeast neighborhoods, young black girls begin vanishing without explanation. They're all between the ages of 10 and 18. They disappear while walking to school, running errands, or heading home from a friend's house. Their bodies reappear days or weeks later, discarded along highways and embankments. Each shows signs of sexual assault. Most were strangled. One had her own shoelaces tied around her neck. The press calls him the Freeway Phantom. But in the neighborhoods where the victims lived, he was something worse. A ghost no one was hunting. 6 confirmed victims are tied to the Freeway Phantom. Carol Spinks, age 13, abducted April 25, 1971, on her way to buy groceries, found 6 days later beside I-295. Darlenia Johnson, age 16, missing July 8, 1971. Body discovered 11 days later in a wooded area near the freeway. Brenda Crockett, age 10, vanished July 27, 1971. Found the next morning, strangled with a scarf. Nenomoshia Yates, age 12, disappeared October 1, 1971. Found just hours later near Pennsylvania Avenue SE. Brenda Woodard, age 18, last seen November 15, 1971, found the same night near Route 202. A handwritten note was found in her pocket. Diane Williams, age 17, last seen September 5, 1972. Her body was found the next day along I-295. Each girl was black, each from working-class neighborhoods. Each case was mishandled in ways that still anger families today. The most disturbing detail came with Brenda Woodard's murder. Stuffed in her coat pocket was a typed note. It read, "This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you catch me if you can." It was signed simply, "Freeway Phantom." Investigators believed the note was real. It contained details only the killer could have known. Brenda's case became the only one with a tangible trace of the killer's mind. It was chilling, confident, cold. And it offered no real leads. From the beginning, the police response was fractured. Different jurisdictions handled the cases. There was no unified task force at first. Files were misfiled. Leads went unpursued. One detective would later admit, "Had the victims been from wealthier areas, I believe more urgency would have been shown." The FBI eventually got involved, but the damage was done. Witnesses were gone. Scenes contaminated, evidence lost, a serial killer was hunting children in the nation's capital, and almost no one was listening. Several theories emerged. 1. The Starlight Gang. A group of men known for drug trafficking and extortion in D.C. were considered suspects. One had a connection to Brenda Woodard. Police interrogated them, but nothing stuck. 2. A Metropolitan Police Officer. An internal tip suggested the killer may have been in law enforcement. The typed note, knowledge of geography, and victim manipulation hinted at someone with authority. But no officer was ever charged. 3. A Lone Predator. Some profilers believe the killer was a loner with military or clerical experience. The phrasing in the note, tantamount to my insensitivity, was unusually formal, suggesting higher education or practiced writing skills. Still, no suspect was ever identified. In the 1970s, DNA testing didn't exist. By the time forensic science advanced, most of the evidence was degraded or missing. Clothing, hair samples, and the original typewritten note were either lost or mishandled. A 2004 review by cold case detectives found the physical trail too cold. Even now, there is no usable DNA tied to the freeway phantom. What makes this case even more terrifying is the killer's control. He never contacted media, never called police. He knew the city's layout. He waited months between attacks, long enough to confuse patterns, but not long enough to be forgotten. He may have lived in the community, blending in during the day and stalking victims at night. One profiler described him as intelligent, mobile, and capable of manipulation. Possibly someone respected. Possibly someone trusted. That may be why none of the girls screamed, why they got into his car, because they thought they were safe. The families of the victims never stopped pushing for justice. Carol Spinks's sister, Evander, has spoken at rallies and press conferences for decades. In a 2021 interview, she said, "We were little black girls in the 70s. We didn't matter to them. But we mattered to someone. We mattered to our mothers." Brenda Crockett's cousin organized a yearly memorial vigil on the anniversary of her death. He carries a photo of her in his wallet, aged artificially to show what she might look like today. She would have been a mother, maybe a teacher, maybe a nurse. That was stolen. In 2021, a renewed effort by the D.C. Metro Police Department and the FBI began digitizing old files. A few clues have emerged. A redacted tip about a military contractor, a re-interview of a former suspect's family, a grainy 1972 photo possibly showing a car linked to one of the abductions, but it's not enough. The killer may be dead, or he may still be alive. An old man walking free, with the names of 6 girls carved somewhere in his memory. The freeway phantom didn't just murder children. He exposed a system that wasn't ready to protect them. He preyed on the vulnerable, hid in plain sight, and vanished into the noise of a divided city. 50 years later, the victims' names are etched in memorials, but not in justice. They were daughters, sisters, students, and someone is still carrying the secret of what really happened along those D.C. highways. It starts with a strand of hair, a drop of blood, a cigarette stub, a skin cell on a coat collar. For decades, these scraps were collected and stored in evidence lockers, marked unresolved and left in the dark. But the future came knocking. Today, cold cases once thought impossible to solve are being revived by the twin forces of forensic science and relentless determination. New technologies, fresh eyes, and grieving families who refuse to quit have given the dead a second chance to be heard. This is the reckoning. In the 1970s and 80s, evidence was physical. Notes, footprints, witness accounts. DNA wasn't a tool. It was a mystery. Today, genetic genealogy can trace a single DNA fragment to an extended family tree. Touch DNA can reveal a killer from the skin oil left on a doorknob. AI forensic software can identify partial fingerprints long dismissed. And when science speaks, silence has nowhere to hide. Let's return to the cases you've heard. D.B. Cooper. The titanium particles found on his tie in 2007 pointed to aerospace environments. In 2022, further testing narrowed the possibilities to 3 Boeing assembly sites active in the late 60s. No arrests, But for the first time in 50 years, the list of suspects shrunk dramatically. The Bundaberg taxi murder. In 2023, Queensland Forensic Labs retested Rachel McKenzie's clothes with updated mitochondrial DNA sequencing. A partial familial match led to a second cousin in New South Wales. The suspect? A now-deceased man with a history of violence. The case remains open, but no longer blind. Louisa Dunn. Her fingernail scrapings, saved in a mislabeled envelope, produced degraded DNA, but a 2024 AI-enhanced technique produced a composite sketch based on microbial skin DNA left on her robe cord, giving the public a face never before seen. Rachel and Mary Vaughan. A 2025 independent team working with marine biologists used water flow simulations to narrow Mary's possible drop point. Cadaver dogs and ground-penetrating radar will return to the Port Adelaide mangroves next spring. It may be the last shot at answers. Jeanette De Palma. Though much of her evidence is missing, activists and journalists have forced the New Jersey State Police to re-interview witnesses and review surviving artifacts. A request to exhume Jeanette for full reanalysis is under court consideration. A state senator is now backing the motion. The Freeway Phantom. Though the killer has never been named, digitized files in 2023 uncovered previously lost notes, a partial license plate, a phone number scribbled on the corner of a victim's school book, and a matchbox from a now-defunct Virginia diner. A new cold case task force is quietly investigating a former city contractor. The role of family's technology matters, but so does love. In nearly every cold case that's made progress in recent years, there's a common thread. A family that wouldn't quit. Sisters who read police reports line by line. Sons who comb through public records. Nieces who file court petitions. Retired detectives who reopen boxes long ignored. Their pressure forces action. Their grief fuels investigations. They are the heartbeat behind every headline that reads, "Case reopened." The cold case revolution today, the landscape of criminal investigation has evolved. Forensic genealogy. Sites like GEDmatch have helped solve over 150 cold cases using family trees. AI-driven pattern matching. Software now detects crime scene similarities humans might miss. Lighting patterns, victim profiles, even emotional tone. Private DNA labs. Organizations like Othram and Parabon Nano Labs now work independently from overwhelmed public labs, focusing exclusively on long-forgotten victims. Every day, new tools are being created. But even now, thousands of cold cases sit untouched in evidence rooms, waiting. The financial fight one. One of the biggest barriers to justice? Money. Running a single full-spectrum DNA test can cost up to $7,000. Genealogy analysis adds more. Many departments, especially rural or underfunded ones, can't afford it. That's where nonprofits step in. Groups like the Cold Case Foundation, the Doe Network, and Season of Justice are changing the game, providing funding, technical support, and national exposure. In some cases, it's been a $20 donation from a stranger that brought a killer to justice. Why this matters. When cold cases stay cold, killers stay free. Survivors never get closure. Communities remain in fear. And a system that forgets its dead loses part of its soul. But every case reopened reminds us that time does not heal all wounds. That grief can become action, and that science is not bound by memory. Justice may be delayed, but it is not impossible. You've heard six stories of horror, confusion, and silence. Each was real. Each left a hole that never closed. Now you know about the girl whose death sparked satanic panic, the man who hijacked a plane and vanished. The mothers who marched in D.C. while a predator roamed free. But what you haven't heard yet is this. You might be the missing piece. Someone out there knows something. A name, a car, a conversation long buried. In the age of digital footprints and DNA miracles, even the smallest memory can light a fire. Cold cases are not just old news. They are living wounds, waiting to be named, faced, and healed. And somewhere, in a box of forgotten evidence, or in the mind of someone afraid to speak, is the key. To Rachel, to Louisa, to Mary, to Jeanette, to Brenda, to Diane, to every name not yet printed, every photo still hanging on a grandmother's wall. Justice is slow, but it is still moving. One strand of hair at a time. Precision. He is calm. Polite, even. As the flight circles Seattle for 2 hours, law enforcement gathers the ransom and parachutes. Cooper gives strict instructions. No tricks, no cops, no funny business. At 5:39 p.m., the plane lands. Passengers are exchanged for money and parachutes. Cooper lets all 36 passengers go unharmed, keeping only a few crew members aboard. He requests the plane fly to Mexico City. With flaps down, gear down, at a low altitude of 10,000 feet, he knows aircraft. Then he does something no one expects. Somewhere over the dense forests of southwest Washington, in heavy rain and freezing wind, Cooper opens the rear air stair of the 727, a feature that, at the time, was not equipped with mid-air locks. He takes the money, ties it in a bag, straps on a parachute, and jumps. Into complete darkness, the plane lands safely. But Cooper is gone. What followed was one of the most extensive manhunts in U.S. history. Thousands of people were interviewed. Military personnel scoured the woods and rivers. Helicopters and troops combed the landscape. They found nothing. No body, no parachute, no briefcase, no trace, until 9 years later. In 1980, a boy digging near the Columbia River found three bundles of decaying $20 bills totaling $5,800. Serial numbers matched the ransom. That's all. No other physical evidence ever emerged. Over the decades, the FBI worked with forensic specialists, hydrologists, and aerospace experts. Several suspects emerged. All were ruled out. In a twist, Cooper left behind a black clip-on tie on his seat. In 2007, scientists analyzed the tie with electron microscopes. They found titanium particles, the kind used in aerospace or chemical manufacturing. This suggested Cooper may have worked in a high-tech or engineering industry. The detail added weight to theories that Cooper wasn't a criminal at all, but someone with specialized training. Military, Boeing employee, government. Still, it wasn't enough. Many names were floated. Richard McCoy hijacked a plane in a similar fashion in 1972, but he was ruled out. Different appearance, no evidence. Kenneth Christensen, a former paratrooper and Northwest employee. Circumstantial at best. Robert Rackstraw, a Vietnam veteran with explosives experience and a shady past. His military background made him a compelling candidate. But the FBI didn't find conclusive proof. Then there's Barbara Dayton, a transgender woman and skilled pilot who confessed before her death that she was Cooper. Investigators dismissed her claim as delusional. In 2016, after 45 years, the FBI officially closed the case. In 2020, private investigators working with the Cooper research team uncovered documents suggesting a man named Lynn Doyle Cooper, who had a criminal background and allegedly planned something suspicious around Thanksgiving 1971. But no DNA, no photos, just whispers. In 2023, titanium particles on the tie led to new speculation that Cooper worked in Boeing's cutting-edge development teams in the 1960s and 70s. Again, no names, no proof. The forensic breakthroughs are tantalizing, but still incomplete. Why did Cooper do it? The amount of money, $200,000 in 1971, was significant, but not impossible to trace. The parachute jump was nearly suicidal, and he was unfailingly polite throughout. He addressed people by name. He tipped the flight crew in small talk. He even paid for his ticket like a regular commuter. Some theorize he died during the jump. Others believe he escaped and lived quietly, never spending the money. Either way, the case left more questions than answers. More than 50 years have passed. The tie still sits in a vault. The money recovered in the river is brittle and faded. and the sky over southwest Washington still holds its secret. Dan Cooper, or whoever he truly was, walked into history and vanished. He remains a symbol of audacity, calculation, and mystery. No confirmed identity, no body, no closure, just a man in a suit, in the rain, stepping into darkness with a bag of money, and vanishing forever. August 11th, 1987, Bundaberg, Queensland. It's just past midnight. The sugarcane fields are quiet. A taxi sits idling on the edge of a rural road, its driver's door open, engine running, meter still ticking. Inside, 51-year-old Tom McKenzie, is slumped over the steering wheel. Blood soaks the upholstery. His throat has been cut. His last breath, witnesses later say, was a single word muttered before he collapsed. Sykes. No one knew what it meant, and no one named Sykes was ever found. Tom McKenzie had driven taxis for over 20 years. He was a father, a grandfather, and a man known for his discipline. That night he picked up a late fare in central Bundaberg, something he'd done countless times. But somewhere between the pickup point and the lonely edge of a cane field, something went terribly wrong. There were no witnesses to the crime. No CCTV. Just blood, tire marks, and the lingering hum of the idling car. The cash drawer in his taxi hadn't been touched. Detectives combed the sugarcane fields for evidence. The crime scene was brutal. His throat had been slashed with precision, suggesting the killer may have had experience or training. There were no fingerprints, no murder weapon. But there was one cryptic clue. A local woman reportedly heard Tom groan one final word before collapsing outside his cab. Sykes. Queensland police launched a full-scale investigation. Over 800 people were interviewed. Hundreds of tip-offs came in. Not a single one led to a man named Sykes. The name became a ghost. Tom's son, Darren McKenzie, was just a teenager when his father was killed. Now in his 50s, Darren still carries the weight of that night. He's never stopped searching for answers. In interviews decades later, he said, "They told us it was a robbery gone wrong. But if it was, why didn't they take the money? Why kill him with such brutality? It doesn't make sense." What Darren learned over the years would take the case from a local tragedy to a national mystery. Years after the murder, Darren began digging through old records, news clippings, and crime files. He found something chilling. Bundaberg wasn't the only place where taxi drivers were attacked in the 1980s. Across Queensland and New South Wales, at least five taxi drivers had been killed between 1984 and 1989, each under eerily similar circumstances. All were middle-aged men working night shifts. All were found in rural or industrial areas. And in nearly every case, the driver's cash was untouched. Could these have been the work of a serial offender? Police said no, but the timing and details were difficult to ignore. In 2005, forensic investigators re-examined Tom's clothing and the taxi interior using advanced DNA testing. There were several partial profiles, but no match in any national database. Queensland. Police stated publicly that unless a suspect was named, the DNA couldn't do much. They needed someone to compare it to. So the name Sykes resurfaced. Detectives tried everything, every variation of the name, including alternate spellings, street nicknames, even aliases used by local bikers and transient laborers. No match, no Sykes, nothing. In 2020, a small break emerged, not from police, but from Darren himself. After submitting a Freedom of Information request, he uncovered an old 1987 report about a man who had recently arrived in Bundaberg using the alias Sykes. The man had a history of assault in New South Wales and was staying at a budget hotel near the taxi rank where Tom last picked up a fare. The report claimed the man had fled town 2 days after the murder. His real name? Still redacted. For reasons never publicly explained, that report was buried and never followed up. Darren believes it was a cover-up. Police say it was insufficiently credible. Criminal profilers brought into the case years later believe the killer may have been a thrill seeker, someone who wanted to feel control, not someone desperate for money. The precise cut to Tom's throat The choice of location and the lack of theft suggest the killer wanted to make a point, not rob someone. What that point was, no one can say. In 2022, Queensland police increased the reward to $500,000 for information leading to a conviction. Darren McKenzie welcomed the gesture but remained skeptical. "My dad didn't die in some back alley fight. He was executed, and they're still calling it a robbery." He continues to run a small Facebook group and digital archive dedicated to keeping the case alive. Each year, on the anniversary of the murder, he returns to the edge of that cane field. He says he still listens for that name. Tom McKenzie's death remains one of the most baffling unsolved murders in Australian history. A man whispered a name as he bled to death, and that name vanished into silence. 40 years on, the field is still quiet. The wind still rustles through the cane, and somewhere out there, someone knows who Sykes was and why Tom had to die. May 23, 1967. A quiet afternoon in the London suburb of Clapham. A neighbor knocks on the door of 28-year-old Louisa Dunn's flat. She hasn't been seen in days, and her milk deliveries have begun piling up. The door is locked. The silence is heavy. When police finally force their way inside, they find Louisa lying face down in the hallway. She's been strangled with the cord from her own dressing gown. Her body shows signs of a struggle. One of her shoes is missing. Her purse is untouched. No forced entry, no witnesses, no motive. And then, nothing. For over half a century, the case would remain unsolved. Until, in 2023, a single envelope, sealed and long forgotten, rewrote everything. Louisa was a social worker. She had moved from the Midlands to London in 1965 to work in child welfare. Friends described her as warm, clever, and politically aware. An early feminist with a sharp wit and a big heart. She lived alone, had no criminal ties, and had never reported any threats. There were no signs of a burglary, no sexual assault, and no evidence of drugs or alcohol. Just a brutal killing. Clean, quick, and personal. In 1967, investigators focused on two leads. A male acquaintance, reportedly seen near her flat the night she died, a mystery man she had met at a local cafe weeks earlier, whom she reportedly described as strange but kind. Neither lead led to an arrest. Fingerprints at the scene were partial. Neighbors remembered hearing a muffled argument, but no screams. No one was ever charged. As the months passed, the case faded, like many crimes of the era, into bureaucratic storage. But her family never stopped asking. In 2021, as part of a nationwide push to digitize cold cases, retired Detective Inspector Mark Avery reviewed archived files from unsolved murders in South London. He came across a mislabeled box. Inside, he found a sealed manila envelope marked LD Case Evidence, 1967, Do Not Destroy. Inside, a robe cord, Louisa's fingernail scrapings, a cigarette butt, and a yellowed notebook that appeared to be Louisa's personal journal. Crucially, the fingernail evidence had never been DNA tested. It predated forensic science. And the notebook? It included three dates, a few cryptic names, and one phrase scribbled hastily. "He's coming Thursday." "I said no." "He said, I owe him." The date matched the day before she died. Using modern techniques, the scrapings beneath Louisa's fingernails yielded a partial male DNA profile. Though it wasn't enough for a full match, it was enough to cross-check existing suspects. And one name from the original case notes stood out. Franklin Teague. Teague had briefly dated Louisa in early 1967 and had been questioned at the time, but he claimed he hadn't seen her in months. He was never arrested. Now, 56 years later, forensic scientists requested a sample from Teague, now living in Kent as an 80-year-old retired librarian. The partial DNA was a familial match. When police arrived at his home, Teague reportedly said only three words, "I wondered when." Teague was arrested on suspicion of murder in July 2023. In his first police interview, he denied killing Louisa but admitted to seeing her the night she died, something he had previously denied. He said they argued. He said she pushed him. He claimed she was frantic. He said he left, and that was all. But prosecutors saw something else. Motive, opportunity, a misleading alibi, and DNA from the scene. A judge ruled that there was enough evidence to proceed to trial. In spring 2024, the trial of Franklin Teague opened at the Old Bailey. The prosecution leaned heavily on Louisa's journal entry. The altered timeline Teague admitted to the DNA match under her nails, and a pattern of emotional manipulation uncovered in old letters Teague had written to Louisa. The defense argued that the DNA evidence was too degraded, that Teague had cooperated fully, and that the case was built on circumstantial memory. There was no confession, no murder weapon, no direct witness. And so, after 5 weeks of emotional testimony, the jury deliberated. Franklin Teague was found not guilty. The court cited reasonable doubt, particularly over the forensic integrity of half-century-old samples. Outside the courtroom, Louisa's surviving niece wept. "We waited 56 years for justice, and now there's no second chance." Public reaction to the trial was split. Some argued the system had finally done its job, reviewed a case thoroughly, given it a fair trial, and respected the principle of innocence until guilt is proven. Others saw it as a failure. An old man walked free, but Louisa remained in the ground, without a voice. The reopened case sparked renewed attention toward the backlog of UK cold cases involving women from the 1960s and 70s. Many believe the justice system is only now reckoning with its historical blind spots. Louisa's death is now viewed through a modern lens. A young woman, likely stalked or coerced. A man unable to handle rejection. A culture that dismissed violence against women as domestic. The tragedy is not only that her life was taken, but that her story was shelved, buried under decades of silence. But through persistence, technology, and the work of one retired detective, her name returned to the courtroom. And for a few weeks, the world remembered her. Louisa Dunn should have lived a long life. She should have grown old, had a family, laughed in cafes, and watched the world change. Instead, she became a cold case file, until someone opened the wrong drawer and refused to look away. Justice didn't win, but the truth got its moment, and sometimes that's all we have left to give the dead. Port Adelaide, South Australia. November 2nd, 2008. The mangroves are still, thick with salt water and silence. Sunlight flickers off the muddy water as two fishermen cast their lines near the Outer Harbour shipping yards. Then, one of them sees it, floating just beneath the surface. A human body. Female. It's later identified as 21-year-old Rachel Vaughan, a single mother who vanished 2 days prior. But Rachel wasn't alone. She had left home that morning with her 6-year-old daughter, Mary, who was never seen again. Mary's body has never been found. No one saw them leave. And no one has been charged. This is the story of a mother murdered, a daughter vanished, and a community gripped by one impossible question. Where is Mary? Rachel Vaughan lived a quiet life. She worked part-time in a bakery and was raising Mary alone after separating from the child's father. By all accounts, Rachel was a devoted mother. Never missed a school day, a dance recital, or a family dinner. On October 31, 2008, Rachel called her sister and said she was taking Mary down by the docks for a walk, something she often did on sunny days. That was the last confirmed contact. When Rachel didn't return home that evening, her sister reported her missing. At first, police assumed a domestic issue. Maybe Rachel had run off, they thought. But by the next day, her phone was off, and there was no bank activity. And Mary was silent. Rachel's body was found fully clothed, tangled in mangrove roots, and partially submerged. An autopsy revealed blunt force trauma to the back of her head. No signs of sexual assault. No drugs. No defensive wounds. It was as if someone had struck her from behind, dumped her in the water, and left. There was no trace of Mary, no clothing, no footprints, no blood, no belongings. Police were baffled. The tidal patterns made it impossible to know exactly where Rachel had entered the water. Cadaver dogs and divers scoured the coastline. Nothing. It was as though Mary had vanished into the trees. The case quickly drew national attention. Rachel's ex-partner, Stephen Marsh, was questioned extensively. He had an alibi and showed no signs of abuse or coercion in the relationship. Though their custody agreement had tension, there was no history of violence. Then came another name, Daniel Kinnear, a dock worker with a history of stalking and mental health issues. He lived less than a mile from the mangroves. Witnesses later said he was seen that morning walking alone along the same path Rachel often took. Police interviewed him. His story was inconsistent. He claimed he never saw her that day, but couldn't explain scratches on his hands. Still, there was no DNA, no witnesses, no confession. Kinnear wasn't charged. A week later, a sanitation worker found something odd in a bin near the Port Adelaide rail station. A child's pink backpack. Inside it, a used juice box, a crayon drawing, and a sticker sheet with Mary's name on it. It was confirmed to be hers, but the bag showed no signs of struggle or tearing. It looked placed, clean, dry, untouched by rain or dirt. It was as if someone wanted it to be found. Some detectives believed it was a taunt. Others feared it meant Mary had been trafficked. The bag was dusted for prints. Nothing. Forensic investigators collected soil samples, hair and fabric threads from Rachel's clothing. Some were too degraded to test. One hair, not belonging to Rachel or Mary, was too partial for identification. Surveillance footage from nearby shipping lanes showed nothing. There was no sign of Mary on any ferry, bus, or vehicle. In 2012, a tipster claimed he saw a girl matching Mary's description.